What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? It's estimated over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com today.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, Forward Thinking is back. Don't call it a comeback. We've been here for years. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we wanted to announce that the podcast is back and thank the audience. That's y'all. Thank you people for your support.
We received numerous emails, tweets, Facebook messages, pretty much any way you guys could get in touch with us. I think we saw smoke signals one day asking, where the heck is the podcast? Where's the video series? So quick update. We do Forward Thinking in seasons, and season 3 had just come to an end in October 2015. And then there was discussion about whether or not season 4 would happen. And that discussion happened well above our heads.
Oh, yeah.
We all wanted to do it. Lots of people wanted to do it. In fact, at the end of the day, everyone said they wanted to do it. So we're not sure exactly what the holdup is, but it's all solved now. So now that we're back, we have a couple of podcasts that we actually recorded before we went on hiatus and kind of sat around in our vault. And we want to release the first of those today. It's all about water on Mars.
Yeah, and so this was recorded in, was it early October?
Yeah, very early October.
This was recorded several months ago, and that's why you might hear us referring to things being in the news that are not currently in the news, but were in the news at the time this was recorded.
For example, water on Mars.
But I hope you will enjoy the episode anyway, because I do think it is very interesting, and we hope you will stay tuned for new episodes that we're going to start recording very soon.
Yes. Right,
We've got one more in the can, and then after that, it's all new territory. We have no idea where we're going, no more than you do.
And we don't even know when we're recording yet, because it's been so long since we've all three sat down at this table. Guys, it's been months since the three of us have been at this table together.
I'm kind of reclamped.
Yeah, it's a little overwhelming. It's a little overwhelming for some of us more than others, because some of us have a podcast to record immediately after this. Sorry, Joe. We're going to wrap this up. So let's get right into the Water on Mars episode. And guys, we're so happy that we're back. Can't wait to talk to you about the future more really soon. Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, letting the days go by, water flowing underground. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
I'm Joe McCormick. Jonathan, I don't know if you noticed, but right before this podcast, I was quoting the Talking Heads.
I did not notice.
You were talking about the social media platform Tumblr, which I cannot think of without thinking of, well, I'm a Tumblr.
Oh, nice. Yeah. As it turns out, I had selected that one mere moments before you and Lauren came into the studio. So there was no collusion there. I try to make these a surprise for everyone in the room besides myself. I mean, sometimes I'm surprised, too, if I've forgotten.
Sure.
At any rate, hey, let's talk about some water on Mars, y'all.
Yeah, well, that was a big headline a week ago.
Yeah, when I was on vacation and you guys were holding down the fort, I noticed, guys, I was in a place where I think the internet got there last Tuesday, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a place where information just doesn't get there as quickly as everywhere else. So I knew that there was going to be an announcement that NASA had something to announce that had something to do with Mars. I was convinced they had found Matt Damon. I thought that's what had happened. I thought it was all just an elaborate marketing scheme for The Martian. And it turns out that's only part of it.
Yeah, I mean, NASA is talking to Ridley Scott, and I'll mention that later on. But yeah, no, they had this big press release that was like, water is totes probably on Mars, guys.
Yeah, which depending on how closely you've been paying attention for the last several decades, you might have thought, haven't we known this for a while?
Yeah, I thought that they discovered water on Mars quite a few times, and so they sort of have.
We keep discovering it, found it again. I guess here's the real problem. Here's the reason why they have to keep announcing it. We haven't brought a flag up there yet. So until you have the flag, it's not really official. So that's All right. So here's the actual announcement. This is what was actually announced, that they had uncovered the most compelling evidence so far that liquid water under certain conditions still flows on or just below the surface of Mars. And we'll talk about what that means a little bit later. But before we do that, I thought it might be cool to talk about why is this a big deal in the first place, and also kind of lead up to the other discoveries that you were alluding to, Joe, mm-hmm. the ones that, you know, haven't we heard about water on Mars before? And the answer is yes, but there's reasons why this particular announcement is exciting.
Yeah.
So in general, the conditions on Mars are not favorable for water.
For multiple reasons.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
we're talking about liquid water.
Liquid
here.
Water, right.
Sure, because it's pretty cold.
Yep. So usually, if you're talking about pure water, it would be in ice form. It wouldn't be in liquid form.
Right. It would freeze. Now, occasionally, in some places on Mars, it does get above the freezing point for fresh water.
Right.
Like the warmest conditions on the equator of Mars can sometimes get to like 70 degrees Fahrenheit,
right.
Which sounds nice.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's very pleasant. It's like San Francisco. Mars is basically San Francisco.
Yeah. No, it's not. Because most of the time it's more like Antarctica or worse.
Yeah, that is true, yes. Yeah.
Depending on when you go to San Francisco, can seem that way.
Unlike San Francisco, Mars has no atmosphere.
Yeah, and so that's the
our very thin one.
Yes,
that's the other side of the problem. Yeah. So the very cold temperature means that water either freezes, but the thinness of the atmosphere also means that the boiling point for water is very low. So it very quickly and easily sublimates directly into a gas, into water vapor.
And then you have another issue, which is that Mars's gravity is not as great as Earth's. It's like 37%, something along those lines, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that water vapor gets boiled off into space and does not come back to the water cycle on
Right,
Mars.
Right. It's not trapped the way that it is here
on
Earth.
Yeah. So these conditions all mean that that's why it's not totally covered in water, right? That's
why it's not wet.
Why it's not wet. Exactly. But we have talked about water on Mars many times before. And when I say we, I mean human beings. I don't mean just this podcast.
We've talked about Mars many times before.
Yes, we have. Mars is awesome.
It's doing stuff.
Yeah.
All the time.
I think we're going to have another episode that links more directly with the Martian in the near future to talk about the technology in that story. But let's talk about the various observations and hypotheses about water and Mars.
Sure. Well, people thought there was water on Mars really before we had any good reason to think so.
Yeah. Back in the 19th century, there was an astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli who described the appearance of certain physical features on Mars as canali, not cannoli, which is what you're supposed to take, but you leave the gun, but canali. Canali meaning channels. Now, the word canali looks a lot like the English word canals, right? So there were some people who translated canali into canals. Canals, however, implies that this is a manufactured structure.
Built, right, yeah. Right. Something that humans or, you know, whatever beings, Martians, I guess in this case, have dug out on purpose.
Right, as opposed to channels which could have been carved out through natural processes.
Mm-hmm. So, but as we know, if there's even the slightest misstatement that could be construed as the existence of life on Mars, somebody's going to run with it.
Yes, even before there was a Facebook, there were moments like these.
Incredible, I know, that literally anything happened before Facebook.
Yeah. Can you just imagine what Percival Lowell would have done with Facebook? Percival Lowell's was an American businessman who had an interest in astronomy, and he interpreted canali as being canals. And ran with that idea, really, really pushed the idea that Mars was a planet that had a sophisticated, technologically advanced civilization that had this complex system of canals carved into it that allowed the denizens of Mars, the Martians, to transport goods and, you know, vehicles and get water to distant locations using this system. He really went with that idea, despite the fact that no one in the scientific community had actually proposed it at that point. However, that idea kind of took hold for a while, not just in popular circles, but the scientific community began to say, well, you know, it's possible that maybe these are actual structures and not just natural formations. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then clearly there is some form of intelligent life there.
Yeah, so we should take a better look at it. So let's develop some better telescopes.
Yep, and this happened very slowly. Obviously, it wasn't like an overnight thing, although, you know, it's easiest to look at Mars when it's nighttime. In the 1920s, some improvements in telescope technology gave us a better look at the red planet. And that's when scientists began to observe the geological formations that led them to believe there were snow caps at the poles and that there were canals or channels, one or the other, that actually had liquid in them on the surface of Mars during that time. That was what they believed because their telescopes were not so sensitive that they could actually see into these channels. They could just see the patterns that appeared, that looked like they were channels or canals. You couldn't really be certain, but they were making a best guess. Today,
I mean, if there are canals, there have got to be gondolas.
Yeah. And opera singers. I mean, there's a whole like domino effect that goes on here. There's probably, you know, a giant casino that caters to those folks, like the Venetian, except I guess it would be the Martian.
Pizzerias everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we see how this just leads to rampant speculation. At any rate, Time magazine at that point reported that the scientific belief was that not only was there water on Mars, like flowing water, but also there was an atmosphere, a thick, warm atmosphere on Mars, and vegetation on Mars. British astronomer P.M. Rives postulated that there could even be intelligent life on the planet. This was all based upon just casual observation using the best technology they had at the time. They didn't have any – obviously, they had no evidence of such things. They were just drawing conclusions mm-hmm. based upon what little detail they could see.
Sure. And this would persist for the next couple decades.
Yeah. By the 1940s, there was still a belief that snow would form at the poles. So that there was a precipitation of snow and that it would then melt during the Martian summer and reform in the winter. And photographs seem to indicate that there was some vegetation on Mars. They were actually looking at this area around Mars where there was some brown and green coloration, and they thought that that was indicative of vegetation. By the 1960s, we had developed better close-up imagery of Mars, and scientists were beginning to revise their opinions about water on Mars. In fact, they began to dismiss earlier ideas entirely, sometimes perhaps a little too readily. Mm-hmm. They dismissed the idea that there was snow on Mars. They said, okay, no, there's no precipitation going on here. The areas we're looking at the poles on Mars, those can't be snow. It's most likely that's frozen carbon dioxide, not water. However, in Texas, the McDonald Observatory claimed to have found conclusive proof of water vapor in the Martian atmosphere.
Now, did y'all know that I just went to the McDonald Observatory of weeks ago?
Oh,
now,
that's great.
You went to the actual McDonald Observatory, right? You didn't just stare at a fast food restaurant.
No. In Texas, my wife Rachel and I went to Big Bend National Park, and McDonald Observatory is just north of there.
That's really cool.
So we looked through the telescopes. I got to see Saturn and its moons.
Ooh.
And
that must have been spectacular.
It was amazing. There was a close-up of the Terminator line on the moon.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And
that's where all the T-800s stand.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is, Jonathan. It certainly is. But it was really cool. If you ever get a chance to go to the McDonald Observatory for one of their star parties or other events, I highly recommend it.
Awesome. I'm definitely putting that on my list. The only observatory I've ever gone to is the one that's at the telescope that's at Fernbank here in Atlanta. And I would love to travel to a few different places and check out some other ones. So the observatory, the McDonald Observatory, used spectrometers, and we'll talk more about them a little bit later. And that's what allowed them to detect water vapor. They made observations in 1969 through 1970 and then decided they needed to take a more concentrated approach to this. And they focused on it from 1972 to 1974 over the course of what was nearly a full Martian year.
Okay.
And in that, they were able to detect different varying amounts of water vapor throughout the Martian year. They were always tiny, but then Mars's atmosphere is very thin, as we've said, so you wouldn't expect there to be a lot of water vapor, but they were able to detect it throughout that time.
But by the 1970s, we were starting to send stuff toward Mars, right?
Yeah, and sometimes it would get there.
We had the Viking program, right?
Yep. I recently heard a podcast in which they do a trivia at the end. It's Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Give them a shout out because I love that show. But they do a trivia thing at the very end where the host quizzes the other folks on the podcast. They are not given the questions ahead of time. They have to try and figure out they're given a selection. They have to figure out which one of the selection they're given is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And which ones are science. There's one fiction and then the rest are science. And one of the science ones was that there have been 40 missions sent to Mars, but only 18 have been successful. Those are the ones that actually don't count the flybys.
Okay.
So they didn't count flyby missions, just ones sent specifically to Mars, either an orbiter or a lander, you know, a rover, anything like that. So less than 50% success rate. This is a big deal. In the 1970s, specifically in 1976, the Viking 2 orbiter sent back data that showed frozen water at the North Pole of Mars. And new theories emerged that suggested there was probably a level of permafrost beneath the surface of Mars. So you have regolith covering up a level of permafrost. And they even thought there might be the possibility that the poles, it's not just that there's ice formed there, but rather there's an enormous body of ice that is concealed by regolith. And it's more or less like a giant iceberg, except in the ground as opposed to floating in an ocean. So I thought that was pretty cool. Now, skipping ahead, because obviously we study Mars quite a bit over the decades, but in the 1990s, orbiters sent by NASA and the European Space Agency discovered more evidence of water, at least in the form of ice, not flowing water, but ice on Mars. There appeared to be evidence for precipitation and flowing water as well in Mars's past, if not the present. So they saw areas like geological formations that suggested there was definitely some flowing water at some point in Mars's past, probably a weather cycle of some sort, precipitation of some sort, but they did not directly observe any of that, you know, happening present day. So the conclusion was perhaps this was something that happened in the distant past, and since then had things had changed. skip ahead to 2008, that's when the Phoenix lander dug up some bright material that disappeared over the course of a few days, and NASA concluded that it was, in fact, water ice. It also detected the presence of water vapor within the Martian atmosphere. And the rovers Spirit and Opportunity also uncovered evidence of ice. Curiosity even drove through an ancient riverbed that held water billions of years ago, but no longer. So it didn't have to ford a river or anything. In 2015, this year, the year that we're recording this, before the most recent evidence was made public, NASA announced a hypothesis that billions of years ago, the northern hemisphere of Mars was essentially an enormous ocean. A large portion of it, at any rate, was underwater. So they drew this conclusion based upon data that was gathered by the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile and the W.M. Keck Observatory and NASA Infrared Telescope Facility in Hawaii. So scientists calculated that one time there was enough water on Mars to cover the entire planet at an average depth of 450 feet or about 137 meters.
But the way that water works is usually not that it's covering an entire planet.
Yeah, it was actually based upon their guesses, because again, these are all hypotheses. No one was around back then to check up on their work, that the northern hemisphere sections of it were probably just a gigantic ocean, and that this ocean had depths that would reach more than a mile or 1.6 kilometers in some places. If that's correct, that would mean that the ocean would have covered about 19% of Mars's surface, and you can compare that to something like the Atlantic Ocean here on Earth. That covers 17% of the Earth's surface, keeping in mind that Mars is, of course, smaller than Earth. It's not like a one-to-one comparison. Also in 2015, the Curiosity rover uncovered evidence that water could be in liquid form on the Martian surface due to salts in the Martian soil. We'll talk more about this in a minute, too. So the salts could dissolve in water, and when you dissolve salts in water, that lowers the freezing temperature of that water. So if you have the right type of salts, you can significantly lower that freezing temperature. Mm-hmm. And so under those conditions, at least, and at least temporarily, there could be liquid water on Mars's surface. And the general hypothesis, which we'll talk more about again in a little bit, was that the materials on the surface of Mars could actually absorb water vapor in the atmosphere and turn into liquid water that way. So it's not like the ice was melting and then flowing through, but rather that
or that it was being rained down on the surface.
Yeah, exactly. It was more that it was kind of almost like a condensation sort of thing, except really absorption, not condensation. So that's kind of everything leading up to the most recent announcement.
Yeah. So what was the most recent announcement? Well, it was the newest and strongest evidence of flowing water on Mars. And it was actually research that was published in a Nature Geoscience paper on September 28th, 2015. And then it was picked up by NASA, which gave a press release on it and then did a big announcement and had a big media, what would you call it? A media buffet.
Yeah. or a lot of maybe water cooler talk.
Martian water coolers. Yeah. And
I wanted to point out, the lead author of the study was a graduate student from our own Georgia Tech right here in Atlanta.
Your own Georgia Tech. Go Bulldogs. Woof, woof.
Well, our city's own Georgia Tech, and he was named Lujendra Oja. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. If not, I'm sure I'll get some email. But anyway, what was this new evidence? Of course, Jonathan, you brought up the idea of fording a river. I did hope when we first heard about this that the Curiosity rover had come up to a river and then was given the option, well, do you want to build a raft or ford it or give the ferryman 2 barrels of salt pork?
Oh, I thought it was going to be like the Mars equivalent of Oregon Trail. Like, oh, the Curiosity rover has got dysentery and broke a leg.
Oh, no.
Two spare wheels were lost.
Yeah, now it has to go shoot a Mars bear.
Yeah, that's a great game. That was not what happened. Obviously, the Curiosity rover did not come across a large body of water on Mars. That's not how this discovery was made.
No, in fact, it wasn't the Curiosity rover at all, but it was following up on the same lead you mentioned earlier about
the salts.
Yeah, the hydrated salts in the soil of Mars. So the evidence came from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the MRO, And what it was looking into was that on some downhill slopes on Mars, you can see dark streaks that have been given the name recurring slope lineae, or RSL. And these dark streaks have a tendency to grow darker and move downhill in the warmer seasons. And on Mars, the warm season means when the temperature is above negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 23 degrees Celsius.
Absolutely balmy.
And then, of course, when the weather on Mars gets colder again, they fade away. And there are a lot of these things. There are thousands of them. An imaging instrument on the MRO has captured images of RSLs at dozens of sites on the surface of Mars.
Right. So that leads to the question, what could be causing this discoloration, if you will, this change of the color of the soil on Mars through the warmer months and then the retreat of that in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when we want to try to figure out what is going on with changes in the color of an object, we can use a spectrometer.
Right. So there's an imaging spectrometer called the Compact Reconnaissance Imaging Spectrometer for Mars, or the CRISM.
CRISM.
That these researchers used to determine that the darkened streaks were hydrated salts. And, of course, what does a spectrometer do? It uses what we know about how different types of molecules or materials absorb different spectra of light. And then it looks at the colors of light to determine what molecules are probably present in the object it's looking at.
Yes, we use this a lot in astronomy, also in chemistry, obviously, but in astronomy in order to kind of get an idea of what distant bodies may be composed of if we aren't able to get direct access to those things.
Yeah. So when they looked at the RSL locations that were, I guess you could call them waxing, the ones that are growing wider
okay.
and darker,
mm-hmm.
They detected hydrated salts with the CRISM. And then they looked at the same sites when the RSLs had retreated and they did not detect hydrated salts with the spectrometer. So it looks like salts equals streaks, no salts equals no streaks.
Okay.
Interesting. So this kind of goes back to what that previous hypothesis I mentioned from earlier in 2015 stated, the idea that there are these materials, these salts on Mars that occasionally absorb water through some means, whether mm-hmm. it's through the water vapor or something else that we're not yet aware of.
Lower the freezing temperature of that water.
Yeah, which allows it to be in liquid form rather than just water vapor or ice.
Yeah, and so you're familiar with how salt changes the freezing temperature of water. Mm-hmm. If you've ever seen a salted road or just poured salt on an ice cube for fun, or had ice cream, which has salt in it to, you know, help it get all ice creamy. Except that the hydrated salts detected in this research weren't just standard earth salt, which would be NaCl or sodium chloride, the table salt we all know and love and pour in our mouths.
Directly into my mouth all the time, yes.
So sodium chloride can lower the freezing temperature of water a good bit based on how much salt is mixed in with the water. So according to our HowStuffWorks article on this, a 10% salt solution freezes at 20 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 6 degrees Celsius. And a 20% solution freezes at 2 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 16. I tried to see what the lowest was. I found one website saying that that if you get to the point where the water is completely saturated with salt and
right.
will not absorb any more salt, the freezing temperature will go all the way down to negative 6 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 21 C.
Gotcha. So, obviously you're limited by the chemicals that are dissolved
yeah.
within the water, right? And if it reaches saturation and the freezing point is still higher than the low temperature, then it's still going to
yeah.
freeze.
Table salt wouldn't cut it on Mars. But according to the authors of the Nature Geoscience paper, this announcement is based on the data returned from the imaging spectrometer makes it look like these hydrated salts found on the downhill flows are minerals called perchlorates. Specifically, quote, a mixture of magnesium perchlorate, magnesium chlorate, and sodium perchlorate.
Why is this significant?
Because these perchlorates are salts on steroids when it comes to changing the properties of water.
Mm-hmm.
Some perchlorates can lower the freezing temperature of water below negative 94 degrees Fahrenheit
Ooh.
Or negative 70 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
So,
yeah, having liquid water at that temperature is...
It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the evidence is not, we should specify, that there are strong flowing rivers somewhere on the surface of Mars.
Really super super cold flowing rivers.
Yeah. This is flowing water, but it's probably only and I want to quote the NASA press release here, a shallow subsurface flow with enough water wicking to the surface to explain the darkening. So a more apt analogy would be to think of water sort of flowing through a sponge instead of rushing over the top of a surface.
Right, right. So that then leads us to a question that we don't necessarily have an answer for yet, although we have some good hypotheses about it. Where is this water coming from?
That's a good question. We don't know. You mentioned earlier the hypothesis was that it was being absorbed from the atmosphere. But a tough thing about that is our data on the Martian atmosphere says that it's not wet. There's very, very little water vapor.
It's pretty dry, yeah.
In the Martian atmosphere, not enough that the soil would really be able to absorb it. So unless our data is not accurate about that, it's probably not coming from the atmosphere. Or it may be that our data is coming from a part of the atmosphere that's different from the lower atmosphere where these salts could be absorbing water vapor from.
But let's say that our data is correct. If it's not coming from above, it would necessarily have to be coming from below.
And that's another cool possibility. It could be that there are aquifers under the ground on the surface of Mars that when the warmer months come along, when the warmer times come along, the aquifers under the ground unfreeze, they melt, and then some of the water seeps up to be absorbed by these perchlorates, by these salts near the surface of the planet, and then we get the wet salts.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So, I love that when we get announcements like these, it leads to more questions for us to ask and attempt to answer. And some of these questions we may ultimately be able to answer through direct observation or through various tests. There are other questions that might end up being a little tougher to answer, at least in the foreseeable future. One of the big questions we have is, does this mean that there could actually be life on Mars?
That's the pretty big one.
That's a giant question.
It's definitely what all the media people want to know. I watched a couple of interviews with the lead author of this paper, the guy from Georgia Tech, and there were all these reporters were asking questions about the discovery, but the thing they wanted to know was, does this mean there's life on Mars? And it seemed to me like he didn't really have a very strong opinion on that, and he was more interested in talking about the planetary science and
it's like if you go to someone whose discipline is in one area of science and you ask them something of that's in an unconnected science, then I think their answer is probably going to be pretty much the same. Like, well, I guess
not what I was studying at all,
or I guess not, but... or I don't care. Or
yeah. Well, okay.
Buy my album.
there's a couple different kind of arguments that one could make.
Yeah, one thing I saw was there was a really good New York Times article by Kenneth Chang covering this discovery, and it had quotes from scientists both pro and con the idea that this would lend credence to life on Mars. Now, one of the cons came from a NASA astrobiologist named Christopher P. McKay. And to the New York Times, he said the short answer for habitability is that it means nothing.
Right.
So he points out that the water would be way too salty to support life.
At least any life that we have ever observed here on Earth.
Yeah. And he cites the example of a pond in Antarctica called the Don Juan Pond, which sounds really cool.
Don Juan Pond.
Yeah. It's a hot tub.
I was supposed to say it's the sexiest, coldest, saltiest pond in Antarctica.
And it remains liquid even in freezing temperatures because of the presence of high levels of calcium chloride, but it is not a very life-friendly pond.
Right. Yeah. So in this case, we talk about how conditions on Mars are still incredibly tough for any living creature, that even microbes that we've encountered here on Earth. So not just the brininess of the water, which is already a huge issue, but also the temperatures of Mars and the radiation that that the surface of Mars ends up being subjected to. So all of these things mean that It doesn't mean that there's not life on Mars. It just means that we haven't found enough evidence to make us feel confident one way or the other.
Yeah. But there are also arguments that go the other way. The same New York Times article talked to a geophysicist named David E. Stillman, who made the point that some water might be saltier than other water on Mars,
so
in the same way that some water on Earth is saltier than other water. You might not want to live in the Dead Sea, but you could live in some other body of water.
Like the Pacific.
Yeah. And so the idea was that the streaks that only appear in the warmest conditions would require less salt to melt, meaning that maybe they could harbor life even if some other streaks couldn't.
Yeah. There could also be pockets of water under the surface of Mars that are warmed through geological processes that we're not aware of yet that could support life, and we just haven't been able to observe those yet. That's a possibility, although it's one of those that's like – it could be there, or it could not be there.
It could totally not.
Yeah. So it's not even like – it's not a counter argument so much as saying, again, this is not a smoking gun in either direction.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The astrophysics blogger Ethan Siegel, who I follow, also wrote a short piece about this, and he just pointed out that some life forms on Earth do take advantage of really salty conditions, like the desert salt bush, which apparently – sucks up salts to help it retain moisture in dry places.
That's awesome.
And so he wrote, quote, "While large multicellular life doesn't appear to be the norm on Mars, single-celled salt-rich life might be extant today."
First you get the salt, then you get the power, then you get the microbes. So,
yeah, I think that's how it goes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so we've got a rover on Mars. Why don't we just tell it to go check this out?
Well, especially since it's relatively close to the one of the areas that was being observed that led to this discovery. It's just 30 miles away. Curiosity rover, 48 kilometers away from that location.
We don't want it to get stuck in the mud, obviously.
Yeah. The real reason is that it's illegal. Here's the crazy thing.
You said
thing.
Illegal.
It is illegal. There are no necessarily laws on Mars, but there are laws on Earth about what we can do on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those laws was the Outer Space Treaty, which we have talked about previously on this podcast. There are all sorts of conditions within that treaty that indicated what you could and couldn't do in outer space. Like, you're not supposed to weaponize outer space. You can't claim a celestial body as the property of a nation. You can't do that. Well, one of the other things that is covered in this outer space treaty is the idea of contaminating an alien planet or alien body of some sort with life from Earth.
It's the prime directive, basically. Do no harm.
Prime directive down to the single-celled organism level. So, you know, even Kirk and Picard would both say that, all right, sometimes you got to break the prime directive. Well, they would liberally break this this particular part of the prime directive. Because, you know, human beings, we're just big old microbe clouds walking around.
And we're pretty gross.
When we encounter other people, we share microbes. And we take home some of our buddies' microbes whenever we say goodbye. And that just, if you, like right now, in this little tiny room, it's microbe soup.
Mm-hmm. And the curiosity probably has some Earth microbes on it.
Yeah. So microbes are incredible. They can be incredibly resilient, right? We've seen microbes that can survive in near vacuum conditions. We've seen microbes that can survive at really severe temperatures, either really hot or really cold, in lots of different conditions. So because we know that, we cannot be certain that the Curiosity rover is completely free of microbes. And the sterilization processes we have, we can't even be certain that those would eliminate all microbes from the rover. Part of the problem is that if we really, really wanted to be sure, we would be using methods that could damage the rover itself. So you have to balance out, like, well, how can we be reasonably certain that the material is sterilized versus make sure we don't fry the insides of this thing? And that's really a legitimate worry in space exploration. So we have the Curiosity rover. It could technically go and collect samples. Like, it has the ability to do that. But legally speaking, we can't do that because you might contaminate that sample with microbes from Earth, which, one, would mess up any kind of analysis you're doing. You might end up getting a false positive because you detect microbes and it turns out that those just hitched a ride with you in the first place.
Right.
This is very similar to when we thought that we had discovered methane in the atmosphere of Mars, and it turned out that it was likely something that came along with the actual spacecraft and not something that was native to the planet. Then there's also the worry that you could introduce microbes into the biome of a different planet like Mars, and they could potentially harm or eradicate any indigenous life forms. So there's
we found life on Mars and we killed it all.
Yeah, which, hey, we got a long storied past of that kind of stuff in human history.
Yep.
But we would rather not continue that particular part of our development. So that's why the Curiosity rover can't go and sample this stuff. It would be against the law. And this is going to be a big challenge moving forward. This idea of how do we balance finding out whether life exists on this planet and the concern about contaminating or destroying that life in the process. And it's not an easy question to answer. Meanwhile, while we're having those discussions, we're also having discussions about colonizing Mars. And again, human beings being big old microbe, you know, clouds, we would have to worry about contamination there as well. And you could argue, well, these are two separate lines of inquiry that maybe somewhere further down the line we'll have to have them intersect so that we can come to what is a satisfying conclusion. It may even mean amending the treaty, this outer space treaty, in such a way that we can make allowances for certain things like colonization. But
I think we've got a couple decades yet to worry about that.
Yeah, unless you're part of Mars One, where you are convinced that in the next decade you're going to start launching people there, which I think we've pretty much covered as being we're highly skeptical of that.
Is their policy now that they will have launched people by a few months ago?
I think it was actually the launching of people would be in the 2020 decade. But I think that they would have at least started preparations for launch of some of the habitats and other materials.
Right.
But from what I understand, they have raised somewhere less than $500,000, which is nothing when it comes to space exploration.
Yeah.
That's kind of where we are. I do think it was a pretty exciting announcement. I think very much like the lead researcher, I think that the focus has been partially on the wrong part of it. Maybe not wrong. Wrong might be the too strong a word to say. But
No. I mean, it certainly is important for the implications for life. I think it's just people want an answer. Does this mean they want to get you to quote to say, yeah, there's life on Mars now?
And it's the sexy headline. It's a little bit harder to get the common person really excited about salts.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but unless
they're like caramel sea salt or something.
Yeah. No, I want King of Pops.
No.
I think that a lot of the focus has been more on that life question, which obviously is a really big, interesting question, and not so much on how this is yet another example of how science is supposed to work, that we make observations, we develop hypotheses, we try to make further observations to see if those hypotheses are well-founded or not. We test that using whatever methodology we can that is reliable, and then we continue to refine our ideas. This sort of incremental increase in knowledge is incredibly important. It's just not as exciting as those breakthrough moments that we tend to associate with being, you know, important with a capital I, right?
Those rarely happen.
Yeah. To be honest, they very rarely happen. Most of the time, it is a series of incremental improvements that ultimately result in something that in hindsight, you say, oh, here's the big breakthrough. But that's not ever, or at least very rarely, the case. Now, one thing we said earlier, you know, I mentioned The Martian, which was a novel and now a movie, obviously, with Matt Damon starring in it. And Ridley Scott directed it and kind of joked about how this whole announcement was just a marketing campaign for the film, which I don't obviously really believe. But turns out that Director Ridley Scott must have, like, the bat line into NASA, right?
Yeah. So the research, of course, has been kicking around for a while. It's been in the works before this paper was published. And NASA supposedly showed Ridley Scott these photos and talked to him about this evidence, like, a couple months ago, right around when the excitement about his film, The Martian, started picking up.
Mm-hmm.
But the film was already far enough along in production that Scott couldn't use the information to change the course of the film.
Right.
So, A, that's pretty cool. Like, I would like to be a film director who gets phone calls from NASA to be like, hey, there's this upcoming research. Do you want to use it in your movie?
I would like to be a non-film director who gets calls from NASA letting me know what the future holds.
What would you direct? Or do you mean non-film director being anything other than a film director?
No. I mean, I'd be me just as long
just
as...
Average...
I thought you meant a non-film director.
A director of things other than films.
I'd be a director of the FBI.
And... Sir, NASA's on the phone. They say that they found hydrated salts.
Not now. I'm meeting with the cigarette-smoking man.
Speaking of conspiracy theories, so there was this interview with Ridley Scott about the subject in the New York Times, and Scott also threw in this kind of bon mot about humanity's doom being very soonly forthcoming. He stated that he doesn't think that we're going to last more than half a century. So we don't really.
So that singularity and that 20 to 40 years stuff is starting to all sound kind of futile now.
Yeah. So whether or not there's life on Mars, it doesn't matter to us because we're all going to die in the next 50 years. And he said, I quote, I'm not being pessimistic. I think we've done it. So start getting rifles and find some forest retreat up there.
Huh.
Mm.
So
interesting, considering like he has movies that are set in the future, but he doesn't think we'll ever reach a future where those movies would ever be
That's
relevant.
That's why they're science fiction, Jonathan.
I guess so.
They are they're fantasy.
There you go. Hey.
Now, has anyone here actually seen The Martian yet?
No.
I haven't seen it either, but I've read the book.
And I have not read the book either.
It's a very fast read. It's entertaining. I do recommend it. I think the science and technology in the book are pretty good. And we'll do an episode, like I said, talking about what?
Oh, it's funny you said pretty good. I feel like I've heard people praising that up and down for its absolutely like abnormal levels of fidelity.
I would agree with that. I would agree it's abnormal. That being said, there's one thing in particular that the writer himself has admitted was a quote-unquote hand-waving gesture to explain away something that was problematic because he could not science it. He couldn't science his way out of it. And we'll talk about that when we do an episode about The Martian and the science and technology in it. But overall, yes, the science in that movie and in the book are quite good. And they rely on things that exist today. So it doesn't require the invention of all new technology. That technology is better than what we have today, but it doesn't require inventing like the transmogrifier to make everything work. At any rate, we'll talk about that in a future episode. Hopefully after some of us had a chance to see the movie. I am looking forward to it. The first time I saw a preview for it, it convinced me that I had to read the book. So I read the book first, and now I'm hoping to see the movie this week. So at any rate, water on Mars, cool information, doesn't necessarily mean there is life on Mars in any form. Doesn't mean there's not either. We will have to wait to learn more in the future and find a way of doing it so that we're not actually destroying what we're looking for in the process. And it's not an easy solution. Like, there's nothing that's leaping out at us right now.
Here's one I've got.
What's that?
We could sterilize Earth before we send the probe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that Joe and I talked about before we even came in here was that even if we found life on Mars, we wouldn't necessarily know where that life originated.
I mean, we might, but we wouldn't necessarily, because we've talked before on the show about the idea of the panspermia hypothesis.
Right.
The possibility that life on Earth and maybe life in other places in the solar system or even other places in the galaxy shares a common origin, and that it may have been through various impact events or something like that traded between different bodies. So if you were to go to Mars and find something there, let's say you found something there that looked like In some strange way, like a piece of Earth life,
yeah.
You know, that it had, it was DNA based.
It was different enough for us to be reasonably certain it did not hitch a ride aboard whatever, you know, tool we used to discover it on Mars. And yet, was similar enough where it appeared there was a common ancestor.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then I can even imagine, though maybe a microbiologist could tell us why this wouldn't be the case. I could at least imagine a scenario where we would be looking at this and saying, huh, don't know if this hitched a ride from Earth or if
you Earth's
know,
life
this...
hitched a ride from Mars, or if both came from a third source.
Yeah.
Or two separate sources that ultimately share a source further back. Like, this gets super complicated. Mm-hmm. And now, granted, some of these questions get range from science almost into the realm of philosophy, because it may turn out that some of them are unanswerable by our methodologies, that we just don't have the capacity to go to that level of precision to answer them reasonably. But I certainly think it's an interesting thought experiment. And, of course, it's too early to even say anything on the subject right now because we haven't discovered life, any evidence of life on Mars. But we will keep looking in various ways. And, guys, if you guys have any suggestions for future topics of forward thinking, maybe something that you've always wondered about, or there's maybe some interesting science in the news that you think we should cover, let us know. Send us an email. The address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are fwthinking. Over on Facebook, you can just search FW Thinking. We will pop up there. You can leave us a message. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.